you back to the renovated courtroom. Call our third case for today and the last case for September. 99-2580-CR State v. Carl R. Kramer. Thomas Balistrieri, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Balistrieri.
This is like deja vu all over again, almost.
Kind of nice, though, isn't it?
It's been 2 years, and I was looking at all the very subtle changes that were made here. So,
the color of my hair is.
we're all 2 years older than yes. I thought that.
Yeah, right. Hopefully, the sound system is a little better than it used to be.
Sometimes.
Sounds like a microphone.
Maybe.
At any rate, we're here to talk about Carl Kramer today. This is a case that involves a claim of selective prosecution. Selective prosecution is an affirmative defense on which the defendant has the initial burden of producing evidence. Defendant who claims that he was unconstitutionally selected for prosecution has a burden to make a prima facie case of discrimination. Prima facie case requires more than just showing speculation that there might have been selective prosecution. It requires more than showing just a probability. It requires the production of sufficient evidence to enable a reasonable trier of fact to come to the conclusion that the defendant seeks to have the trier of fact come to. In other words, that he was selectively prosecuted. The defendant has to show two things to show a claim of selective prosecution. He has to show both a discriminatory purpose or intent and a discriminatory effect. These are questions of fact which are reviewed on appeal under the standard test for reviewing questions of fact, which is the clearly erroneous test.
Counsel, can you enlighten me as to the word discriminatory? Does that have a pejorative meaning, you know, evil or ascribing bad motives, or does it mean simply a selection, regardless of motive, that, well, I don't know. Tell me what is meant by discriminatory.
Well, it definitely does have a pejorative meaning in this context. It definitely does mean an evil purpose, a purpose to do something bad, to make a selection on the basis of improper criteria, whether it's an inappropriate classification or whether it's to deprive the defendant of the benefit of a constitutional right, but there definitely is an evil purpose that's inherent in the term as used in this context.
And don't you concede that?
What we concede is this. We concede that the defendant has made a prima facie showing of a purpose to discriminate. And I want to stress that he's made a prima facie showing because procedurally in this case, the trial court never got past the prima facie showing. The trial court ruled that Mr. Kramer had never made his prima facie showing and therefore never required the district attorney to come back with rebutting evidence. And we most assuredly do not concede that the prosecutor in this case actually had an intent to discriminate. But we do concede that there's a prima facie showing here. The fact that there was a letter warning of possible prosecution sent to some tavern owners in the county, but not to other tavern owners in the county, and that fact is undisputed.
Counsel. I thought that was it, but there's also one other thing that there were others referred for prosecution, but not prosecuted, as I understand it, that were in the city am I mistaken on the facts? In other words, that there were no taverns outside of North Fond du Lac that were prosecuted, but there were some that were referred for prosecution.
On this record, and then again, I want to stress that we're talking here about the prima facie case. On this record, there is no evidence that any tavern owner outside the village of North Fond du Lac was ever prosecuted for commercial gambling. But all of the taverns in the village of North Fond du Lac were prosecuted.
What other evidence? You can see the prima facie case. You cited to the fact that a letter was sent to some but not to all. Is there ever other evidence that you believe make up this prima facie case? What goes into making up the prima facie case of discriminatory intent and purpose and effect?
Well, in terms of showing a discriminatory purpose, what you have to show is simply intent, and this is the same kind of question of intent.
I'm asking what evidence. In response, Justice Prosser asked you a question, and you started to respond, and I thought you were cut off because you said, we can see the prima facie case. There was, after all, a letter sent to some but not to all.
No, that's it.
I
fully answered the question.
Okay, thank you.
That is the evidence of a discriminatory purpose or intent in this case.
What? That is, the inference can be drawn from the fact that letters were sent to only some people.
That's
an inference of discrimination.
Well, an inference from the disparate distribution of the letter that there was an intent to discriminate against someone.
Then why can't you draw an inference that there's been a prima facie showing of discriminatory effect?
Because discriminatory effect is very different from discriminatory purpose.
What more do you need than was set forth in the Court of Appeals opinion?
You have to show that some people were actually prosecuted and other people who committed the crime were not prosecuted.
Isn't that, and I'm unclear about all this stuff, so I'm asking you to ask these questions. Isn't that really going to your rebuttal of a prima facie?
No.
It seems to me that with regard to your concession of discriminatory purpose, that I'd be fighting tooth and nail on that one. You know, just because a letter was sent, what does that mean? I mean, that means nothing. There needs to be more evidence. But you don't. You say, well, a letter was sent. We have now established, or they have now established, prima facie intent to discriminate. Ooh, that's a big step.
It is a big step.
I know, but when it comes to the prima facie showing for effect, the fact that a letter was sent and only certain people that didn't get the letter were prosecuted, that's not enough to show. It just seems an imbalance. I'd be fighting tooth and nail the whole way. Throw in the case.
Counsel.
Well, we do neither. We take a moderate
position. Okay.
Counsel, and I asked the question before, but I guess I didn't get the answer I wanted, or perhaps I misunderstood your answer. Page 12 of the blue brief says, and this is what I picked, in the cases involving the city of Fond du Lac taverns, the machines were confiscated. The matters were sent to the district attorney's office, and the result, no prosecution. That's what I was referring to.
Okay. What we have in the record here are three police reports. Those police reports show that they deal with two different occasions. On one occasion, the City of Fond du Lac Police Department, and I stress that this is an investigative unit that is different from the sheriff of Fond du Lac County, who co-signed the letter with the district attorney. But the city police department in the city of Fond du Lac did a sweep of every tavern in the city. They found video games in two taverns, out of all of the taverns in the city of Fond du Lac, they found video games in two. They found no evidence that the games were actually used for gambling. And of course, under the decision of the Court of Appeals that's relevant in this case, it is not a crime just to have a video gambling machine. It's only a crime if you use the machine for gambling. So in those first two instances, that's all we have is evidence that the machine was there. There's no evidence of gambling, therefore no evidence of a crime.
Is there any evidence that they gave those machines back?
I'm sorry?
Is there any evidence that they gave those machines back after the Hahn decision?
No.
See, that's what I was... It says they were confiscated in the van. Okay, I assumed that...
Okay, there's no evidence that they were returned. And just to finish up the answer, there is a second incident where a citizen anonymously reported that there was some gambling in a third tavern, but very little proof other than the admissions of the owners. And in that case, again, the machine was confiscated with no evidence in the record that it was ever returned.
So to make a prima facie showing for discriminatory effect, you are saying that the state must show that there were other violations, that the defendant must show that there were other violations that were not prosecuted?
That's generally the case. And what I've tried to do is, because this gets a little confusing in this case because of this, the business with the letter. What I've tried to do is to show, first of all, what a defendant would ordinarily have to show. Let's say there was no letter sent. What would a defendant have to show in order to show discriminatory prosecution? What he would have to show is that the tavern owners in the city of Fond du Lac who were engaged in commercial gambling were prosecuted, but tavern owners in the rest of the county who engaged in commercial gambling were not prosecuted. That would be a showing of a case of discriminatory effect. You would show some people were prosecuted who committed the crime, other people who committed the crime were not prosecuted. And the only difference between them, if I may just finish this with one sentence, is the geographic distribution.
Well, you seem to be conceding an awful lot here. I echo somewhat of what Justice Bradley said. I am not a frequenter of taverns, but I go into them once in a while, watch the ball game, do this, do that. I can't remember the last time I went into a tavern in the state of Wisconsin where I didn't see video games. You know, the one-armed bandits or whatever, and I'm sure I was witness to some payoffs, etc. Are you saying that if the defendant can show that even one or two were not prosecuted, that's sufficient to make a prima facie case? I mean, I would think that the law enforcement simply would not be up to that task. You don't have the tools.
No, I am most certainly not saying that it would be sufficient just to show that one or two were not prosecuted. In fact, in this case, there was one that was not prosecuted, and I steadfastly maintain that is not sufficient. What is sufficient, what would be sufficient to show a prima facie case, it's really hard to say. I mean, I don't think you can quantify it mathematically, because I think it depends on all of the facts that surround the distinction between those who are prosecuted and those who are not prosecuted. So, for example, let's take a situation where we have the taverns in the village of North Fond du Lac that are not prosecuted. And let's say there are two or three or four taverns right across the line in the city of Fond du Lac that are essentially in competition with the taverns in the village that are not prosecuted. I think I would have to concede under those circumstances that given the similarities, given the geographical proximity and the fact that these taverns are in competition with one another, that the showing that these taverns are not prosecuted, two, three, maybe four of them would be enough. But on the other hand, if you're talking about little mom-and-pop taverns out at the country crossroads somewhere over in the far corner of the county, I think you have to take that into consideration in determining how many of them might not have been prosecuted. So it's really hard to say, and I absolutely cannot say with any assurance, to a mathematical certainty, how many of the taverns would not have to be prosecuted before you could make a showing of discriminatory effect. It would just depend on all of these circumstances, and I think this is one of those situations where you'd have to trust the judgment of the trier of fact to see which way one might go. You know, if one trier of fact might reasonably decide yes, there is, one might reasonably decide no, there isn't on the same facts.
Mr. Malastrary, there were two charges against Mr. Kramer. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And one of those charges stem from a July 12, 1996 incident?
That's correct.
And that was before the Hahn case?
That's correct.
And the letter sent to everyone except the, I won't say everyone, but the letter that was sent to tavern keepers primarily outside of North Fond du Lac talked about future prosecutions after September whatever.
Yes.
Doesn't it strike you as somewhat discriminatory to go back in time and prosecute an offense before the Hahn decision?
I'm not sure what you mean by discriminatory, but the Hahn decision did not really expand the law. If anything, it contracted it. The Attorney General had taken a position prior to the Hahn
case. But the District Attorney of Fond du Lac County and the Sheriff of Fond du Lac County had said that the law was vague. That's right out of the letter.
Yeah, they did. They said that. But the Attorney General had taken the position that beyond the Hahn case, and this is where we get into the question of vagueness, the Attorney General had taken the position that gambling machines were illegal per se, regardless of whether or not they were actually used for gambling. The Attorney General's position was that it's a gambling machine, regardless of what it's used for, it's illegal. And that is what was vague. There was never any question, either before or after Hahn, that if you actually used a gambling machine for gambling purposes, that was in violation of the law. So you have to understand what was vague. The part of the law that was vague was found to be not a part of the statute by the Court of Appeals in Hahn. So there's no problem with going back. I mean, what people were doing, if they were actually using these video machines, the video poker machines and video slot machines, for gambling purposes prior to Hahn, they had plenty of warning that that was illegal, because there was nothing vague about the statute in that respect.
But wouldn't it be a fair reading of the letter that was sent from the district attorney and the sheriff that prosecutions were going to be prospective after the receipt of the letter. Let's say the tavern keeper in Rosendale got the letter, and they had been involved in some video gaming before that, notwithstanding the Attorney General of Wisconsin. Wouldn't it have been a fair reading that prosecutions would be after the receipt of the letter?
And again, I think you have to put the letter in context, especially in the context of who the letter was sent to. It was sent to people outside the village of North Fond du Lac, whom neither the sheriff nor the district attorney knew were engaging in gambling activities prior to the letter being sent. In fact, the letter itself plainly indicates that the deputies who were doing the tavern checks in the outlying areas of the county had no idea who had even had these video gambling machines, if anybody did have them. So there was no evidence of any prior gambling by the people who got the letter.
Are you saying that the routine checks by the deputies of these taverns didn't begin until after the receipt of the letter in September?
Well, there were routine checks at the taverns, but they weren't checking to see who had video gambling machines, according to the letter.
They went in sort of like this?
Well, they just weren't looking. I mean, they weren't paying attention.
They're hard to miss, Mr. Ballister.
Could I ask one other question? With respect to the discriminatory intent that you concede for purposes here, are you saying that the defendant proved that for prima facie case purposes?
I'm saying as the Chief Justice so aptly put it, that there is sufficient evidence from which an inference could be drawn that the district attorney intended to discriminate in warning people against future prosecutions.
But you say there's not enough evidence from which to draw an inference that there was a discriminatory purpose. I'm sorry, discriminatory effect. Yes.
What I'm saying is there's no evidence of a discriminatory effect.
And you said, at least according to my notes, which may be wrong, that you would draw the discriminatory effect, the inference of discriminatory effect, to show that some were prosecuted and others who committed the crime were not. Is that correct?
That would be the ordinary situation.
Okay. Wasn't there any testimony here that some who had who used these instruments illegally were not prosecuted?
Only in the case of this one tavern called Beer Nuts in the city of Fond du Lac, there was an anonymous tip phoned into the police that Beer Nuts had been using the machine for gambling. But there was never any eyewitness evidence.
They prosecuted?
They were not prosecuted.
And then the owner and the employee admitted it.
The owner and the employee admitted it. That's correct.
And they were not prosecuted.
And they were not prosecuted.
Even after an admission.
That's correct.
Did they have any immunity?
I'm sorry?
Did they have any immunity? Did they testify under an immunity?
Apparently not. But we have no idea actually when the gambling took place. The gambling may have taken place while the moratorium was still in effect. Also, since the only evidence of gambling came from the owner and the employee, there was no eyewitness gambling, certainly no eyewitness to the gambling, certainly no undercover police officer actually doing the gambling. The evidence that did exist was pretty thin. I mean, they could have denied making the statements. They could have said they were misunderstood. So there was a reason for not prosecuting these.
Was there any public record that there was a prosecution, even if it was unsuccessful, against someone who received the letters?
Against someone who did receive the letters?
Who did not receive
the
letters.
No, there is no evidence of any prosecution against anyone who did not receive
the letter. How many prosecutions were there against those who did receive the letter?
I can't tell you exactly how many prosecutions there were, but at least people associated with all 8 taverns in the city of, in the village of North Fond du Lac were prosecuted. There were
several. Several is the answer to my question.
All the taverns were subject to prosecution. Some of them may have been subjected to more than one.
Okay, so you've got a record, if I understand it, that shows if there was a prosecution, it was against somebody who received the letter.
Someone who did not receive the letter.
Someone who...
That's why I said this case.
Okay. Prosecutions were against whom?
People who did not receive the letter.
And that's what this defendant was. He did not receive the letter. Okay. And there were no prosecutions against those who did receive the letter.
That's correct.
That's what the record shows.
That's what the record shows.
And why from that? I mean, we're really very light. It's just a prima facie case, right? Why can't I draw a reasonable inference from that evidence that it had a discriminatory effect?
Because in order to show a discriminatory effect from the inequitable distribution of the letter, what you would have to show is that there were some people who were engaged in commercial gambling before the letter went out, and that the only reason that these people were not engaged in commercial gambling after the letter went out was that they received the letter.
Who says? I mean, that's what you're saying. Do you have any authority for that?
No.
Okay. So I can draw another rule.
So
I don't have to accept your concept of the necessary evidence to draw an inference.
Well, I think you do. Not on the basis of authority, but certainly on the basis of reason.
So you think I'm unreasonable? All right, tell me why.
Because it's simply, when you have no evidence in the record that people outside the village of North Fond du Lac were ever engaged in commercial gambling, you cannot, from that total lack of evidence, draw an inference that these people were engaged in commercial gambling at one time and stopped because of the letter.
Chief, may I just respond? Okay, let me try some reason. Let's say I have 10 colored pens, and I want to prove what color is the pen in my hand. I can try to prove that the one in my hand is white, or I can try to offer evidence that it's not black, it's not yellow, it's not green, it's not pink. My point is that there are different ways of proving things. One way of proving things, prima facie showing, is what the Court of Appeals says, and that is you can show the ones that were prosecuted. They're the only ones that didn't get the letter. Or you can show a prima facie case by the way you're asserting. Show the ones not prosecuted that should have been. I mean, aren't there just different ways of establishing a prima facie case? What's wrong with that reasoning?
No, what's wrong with the reasoning is that in order to show discrimination, and this is the basic premise here, you have to show, or the defendant has to show, that some people who committed the crime at one time or another, some people who committed the crime were prosecuted, while other people who committed the crime were not prosecuted. If you have two classes of people, one of whom committed the crime, another of whom never committed the crime, and the people who committed the crime were prosecuted, the people who did not commit the crime were not prosecuted, you have no discrimination. That's the way the system is supposed to work.
There's two classes of people, those who received the letters and who didn't receive the letters, and the ones that did receive the letters got were prosecuted.
Because you have to tie it in to violating the law. There's no discrimination unless people who violated the law were not prosecuted. That's where discrimination lies.
Aren't you imposing a burden on the defendant to do the work of law enforcement? I mean, aren't you charging the defendant with going around and, well, you might say ratting on other tavern keepers, or clean it up, establishing evidence that other tavern keepers are committing felonies?
Yes, I am. That's exactly what I'm doing. And that's the way you meet the burden, is by showing that, in fact, other tavern keepers were violating the law. That's what discriminatory prosecution is all about. That's the essence of the defense.
Well, let me ask this before you sit down. Were all 8 tavern keepers in the village of North Fond du Lac prosecuted?
Yes.
Familiar with the case of Mr., I think it's Lang?
I'm not familiar with any specific case.
Isn't there some case of someone who came forward and said, I've been doing the same thing, and then was prosecuted?
Not in this record. Not on this record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bemisteri.
Good afternoon. My name is Stephen Willett, and I always like to, as being a trial lawyer first, put a face to everybody, and so I'd like to introduce to you Carl Kramer. I think that you are all very attuned to the issues, and I would like to set forth what we feel are the critical points that need to be brought forth. And that is what constitutes prima facie, what constitutes the amount of showing to the court necessary to conclude the effect. And the Court of Appeals recognized that one of the ways to do that is to engage in the proof of the negative, to the extent that there was a letter. The letter was sent to 2 subsets, one control group, the control group being the people who were outside of the village of Fond du Lac, and the other, the group within the village of Fond du Lac who received it. Then you look at the effect those two groups. The effect is one group received no prosecutions. The other group was prosecuted in total. That is the way that the Court of Appeals analyzed the cause and effect arrangement here. Now, the state does concede that there is evidence that there was gambling going on with one case outside of the village of Fond du Lac. But it also concedes that there were other video poker machines outside that were confiscated, though there was no evidence that they were actually used for purposes of gambling. What the Court of Appeals set forth in their decision was that to conclude that those machines were to be used for any other purpose belies reason, because in fact that was the purpose to which they were being used in the village of North Fond du Lac, and it belies reason to assume that it would not have been the reason that they would have been possessed in other parts of Fond du Lac County. So when we come to looking at this, it really does come down to the issue of what constitutes probable cause to believe that the effect of that letter was discriminatory and therefore resulting in selective prosecution.
Is probable cause the same thing as prima facie?
Well, Your Honor, in my opinion, it is. And I understand that probable cause has the different levels. Obviously, probable cause to issue a complaint and probable cause to bind over are substantially different. Prima facie is evidence that is evidence which is just, reasonable, or correct, and upon which there can be a clear going forth, if you will, and stands until rebutted. But I think that once we probable cause at the level beyond the preliminary exam is that probable cause, which is a prima facie showing. And its prima facie showing is evidence that holds good until overthrown by other proof. And one of the problems that we have is we can talk about how many angels there are in the head of the pen, but the bottom line comes down to what is sufficient to shift the burden and what is sufficient to give rise to the court requesting for an explanation of why, in fact, citizens in Fond du Lac County are being treated differently.
Now, the initial burden of a prima facie case is on your client. Suppose your client has a prima facie case. Burden of persuasion or burden of going forward with the proof shift to the state?
Correct.
Which one?
It shifts to the state.
Well, burden of persuasion or the burden of going forward with the evidence?
The burden of, well, both, I think. You're,
okay.
The burden shifts to go forth with the evidence and the burden of persuasion. Yeah, that all arises out of the that Dane County Barman case, Your Honor, and that was, in fact, that they requested that the district attorney go forth and offer explanation of why he was prosecuting a traffic accident differently in this instance than he had in all other instances.
And what's the burden of predominance, clear and convincing, beyond a reasonable doubt?
For which?
For,
well, I think all
pardon me?
Hold on.
It is not beyond.
It is not. And it is clear, satisfactory, and convincing, which is the middle burden. Everybody carries in this whole matter. And at for the state, at that point that they, in fact, would put forth why they were choosing to prosecute this group differently than they had other groups.
The Court of Appeals concluded that the defendant was selectively prosecuted and reversed the order denying his motion to dismiss and the judgment of conviction.
My question is, even if you prevail and the court accepts that a prima facie showing of discriminatory effect has been made, why shouldn't this case be remanded to the trial court to allow for the state to go forth and produce witnesses trying to rebut the prima facie showing?
The state is requesting that, and they allege that if you're going to affirm the Court of Appeals decision, they asked for affirmance and remand to take up this very issue, because as Mr. Ballesteri pointed out, the trial court found that there was no discriminatory intent, and so they didn't even move to those issues. Your question is why not do that? And I look back at the Barman case, Your Honor, and basically set forth the facts that what's the state in fact going to do differently than they did in that case, and that is they can come up with some explanations, but this record indicates that those explanations are already in the record, and that if you look at those explanations, they aren't sufficient enough to in fact justify their actions. And that is, of course, that they do not know, other than that one case where, in fact, there was gambling going on in the county.
As I understand the record, the state did have witnesses ready and available to testify regarding the district attorney's justification for his choice of cases to prosecute, but then decided to dismiss the witnesses in light of the trial court's holding, that Kramer had failed to establish discriminatory effect of prima facie showing. Is that correct or is that incorrect?
Well, Your Honor, I was not the trial attorney in this matter, and I wasn't there. That's what it seems to say. The record seems to indicate that that was the case. I don't know who those witnesses were or what they, in fact, would testify to, so it'd be only speculating on my part what kind of witnesses they were or how valid they were.
You weren't the trial attorney.
No, sir.
Is there, can you offer any explanation of why there was not a more concentrated effort to establish illegal commercial gambling outside of North Fond du Lac? I mean, how do we deal with that?
Well, Your Honor, that's a fair question, and I think the answer lies in the extent to which one needs to do that. They did submit an affidavit that there was, in fact, gambling going on the outside. They did present witnesses in the fact that they presented the owner and an employee of Beer Nuts that there was going outside. And I guess it would be, and again, it would be my belief that they felt that they had presented a sufficient enough record to raise the issue of prima facie, and that therefore they felt that if you looked at the totality of the situation, where you have the letter, and you have one group being prosecuted and the other being prosecuted, I don't think that they felt that they needed to prove that there was substantial gambling going on. I don't think that they felt that that was the issue at all. So I think they felt they met the, obviously felt the, met the, burden of prima facie showing, and the trial court didn't agree. Found that they had not.
Is it correct that the circuit judge did not find any discriminatory intent?
Yes, sir.
The state now seems to concede that element and that element alone. Does that make any difference for our consideration?
Well, I think it does. I think that the recognition that the issue of prima facie is the issue of, is there sufficient evidence by which one can draw reasonable inference? And the state properly concedes that when you have a disparity that's created by the action of the state, i.e., a letter and no letter, you have a geographical disparity. They say that is sufficient evidence to draw that there was a discriminatory purpose and or intent. Then I think that that sets the standard by which they are judging prima facie and the evidence sufficient necessary to look at the next, and that is the effect. And if you use the same standard that they used on intent and purpose and move it down to effect, you come to the same conclusion that the Court of Appeals did. And that was that they, in fact, looked at the reality of the fact. The reality of the fact is the effect was as if you got the letter, you were prosecuted. And if you didn't, you didn't. And the common sense of that is that that is an effect, a discriminatory effect. And I think that, again, when we're talking about, well, the way you prove that discriminatory effect is to say, well, there had to be gambling going on and non-gambling going on. I'm not sure that though that is in fact correct, I'm not sure that the Court of Appeals says that you need to prove that there was gambling going on. You have to give rise to the fact that there was prima facie evidence that there was, and you can look at the totality of the situation. Which raises the issue, Mr. Justice, about something that I'm concerned that not be lost in the technical application of the selective prosecution, and that is the issue of justice here. And I think that the Court of Appeals was concerned about that the duty of the prosecutor is to seek justice, not merely a conviction. And they cite in their cases the Peters case, and that's the holding of that case. And it also is it's the prosecutor's interest not to win the case, but to see that justice is done. And I think that if you use that as the application of how you interpret prima facie in this matter, then you can say the showing that there was a letter, no prosecution, no letter, no prosecution is sufficient to say that the effect of not receiving a letter would mean that you would continue an activity that was no longer accepted.
May I ask you, Mr. Willett, one element of this case that troubled me was the prosecution for the July 12th incident. I don't sense that that's of any significance to your case.
Well, Your Honor, it, in fact, set forth their position on that, and that was it was a violation before the letter, and it was a violation after the letter because it was the gambling occurred because of the use of the machine. My client, of course, does think it's important in the fact that he went to a jury trial on it, but he thinks that he had no intent necessary beforehand, before the letter of September, and he didn't have the requisite intent afterwards either. That's why he went to a jury trial, Your Honor. So it is significant to us, but it's significant for a different reason, and that is that we don't feel that we had the intent at any point along the line to violate this statute. Nothing further.
No further questions. Thank you, Mr. Willett. Mr. Balistrieri.
In answer, in further answer to the question that you asked me last, Justice Abrahamson, I want to remind you of something that I started off my argument with, and that is the standard of review that this court has to apply. That is the clearly erroneous standard. This court does not determine de novo whether or not a prima facie case was made.
Now, that's not quite what, as I remember it, the Court of Appeals said. They have a statement about their standard of review, and they divided it into two aspects. Let's see what they say here. It's on page 103 and 4. Historical findings of fact clearly erroneous. That's at the bottom of Appendix 103. However, we review de novo whether the trial court applied the correct legal standard to determine whether those historical facts give rise to a claim of selective prosecution, citing McCollum. If the trial court applied the legal standard, then we review its factual findings on the clearly erroneous. Once a prima facie showing of selective prosecution established, whether the state has provided a rational justification is a question of law, which we review de novo. Do you agree with any of that?
Well, I agree with the first part and the last part, not the middle part.
Okay, that's what I thought. So you are going to say what? That the trial court, to determine whether the trial court applied the correct legal standard, to determine whether these historical facts give rise to a claim of prosecution is a question of fact and the clearly erroneous.
Because you're talking about intent here, you're talking about historical occurrences. You're not talking about whether this meets any particular legal standard. You're talking about what did the prosecutor intend, what was in his mind. Plainly a question of fact. This court has said so many times. And you're saying, what was the effect of this? What did it do? Were there some people who were prosecuted and some people who were not prosecuted, and was there a disparity? Those are historical facts.
And the reason you're reminding me of that because limits our review. It's favorable to you.
I'm sorry?
That standard of review is favorable to you because the trial court held in your favor.
It is favorable to me. Yes, it is.
That's all right. It's legitimate. All right.
The Court of Appeals found that the warning letter did not create an arbitrary trial court's finding, the warning letter did not create an arbitrary classification is clearly erroneous. That seems fuzzy to me. I'm not sure if that's a historical fact or a matter of law. What do you think?
The trial court's
finding that there was no arbitrary classification.
I find the entire opinion of the Court of Appeals pretty fuzzy. I don't understand. understand a lot of it, to be perfectly honest with you, and that's one reason we're here, to get it clarified, to get the situation clarified. To me, the question of intent is plainly a factual question, strictly a factual question, nothing more, nothing less. That's reviewed as a question of fact. Did the prosecutor have this purpose in mind? Is there enough evidence to indicate without the prosecutor coming back and saying, "No, I didn't have that intent." Whether there's enough evidence to suggest that he did.
We have no trial court finding of fact, though, do we, on the issue of discriminatory effect? He stopped after he didn't find discriminatory intent. Is that how it went in the trial court? Or did he make findings on both prongs of the test that the facts are insufficient to establish a prima facie case on discriminatory intent and effect?
You know, I honestly don't remember if he made separate findings on both of those prongs. I can't answer that question.
I mean, the Court of Appeals essentially said that the letter constitutes, and the inferences to be drawn from the letter constitutes a prima facie case on both discriminatory intent and effect.
That's correct.
And furthermore, that nothing the state can say on remand would rebut this prima facie proof, which consists of inferences, and so we're reversing the conviction.
I think that's an accurate statement of what the Court of Appeals held. And I think they're absolutely wrong, which is, again, as I say, why we're here. Thank you.
Mr. Balistri, I have one last question. If this court were to find that the defendant had established a prima facie case to require the DA to put on some evidence, what consequences would that have for the overall system of justice in terms of precedent created?
Well, we're here to determine a rather esoteric question. I have not found any case law anywhere that presents a factual situation that is similar to the one that we have in this case, or at least not sufficiently similar to be worth citing in a brief. I think you are presented with an issue of law that is an issue of first impression in this country, and that is, what does a defendant have to show when there is something like this kind of a letter? And it's not just a letter, but you can have any kind of a situation where a prosecutor threatens prosecution or doesn't threaten prosecution. That sort of thing happens all the time. And in that kind of a situation, then the question is, what does the defendant have to show beyond the fact that some people were threatened or some people were warned? What does the defendant have to show in order to prove that he was not just selectively warned or not selectively warned, but actually selectively prosecuted? So I think there is a very important question that has to be resolved here.
If I may, Chief, if I could ask you a hypothetical, changing the facts a little bit. Suppose the district attorney had sent letters to all the tavern keepers in Fond du Lac County, except those who were Latinos. And the state came forward and conceded that there was a discriminatory intent. Could any inferences have been made about non-Latinos, and there were only prosecutions of Latinos?
I don't think your hypothetical changes the situation one bit. Whether you're talking about discrimination because of racial or ethnic background or whether you're talking about discrimination alleged because of geographic location. In either case, the mere fact that this letter is sent out to one group, and I don't care what the group is, but not another group, may be enough to establish a prima facie case of discriminatory intent, but it's not enough to establish discriminatory effect unless you can show that some people were prosecuted who committed the crime, other people who committed the crime were not prosecuted. So in order to just shift the facts to your hypothetical, if we had a situation where this letter was sent out to Latino tavern owners in Fond du Lac County, but not to members of other ethnic groups who own taverns in Fond du Lac County, but the evidence showed that for some reason only the Latino tavern operators were engaging in commercial gambling and no members of other ethnic groups who own taverns were engaged in commercial gambling, you wouldn't have a case of discriminatory prosecution. You need to show people who violated the law were not prosecuted. And we don't have that showing in this case. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Balistrieri. Thank you, Mr. Gillette. Mr. Balistrieri is here with some frequency. We haven't seen you for a while. It's good to see you back, Mr. Gillette. That concludes our oral arguments for September 2001.